Hi, welcome to this week's program. While the economy appears to be firing on all cylinders with near full employment, hardly any inflation, and a soaring stock market, there are signs of a drag in luxury markets like high-end condos and fine art, wine, and collectible cars, among others. These markets have become more appealing in recent years to rich investors who are wary of low interest rates from bonds and stocks, which they feel are flying high, and yet they don't want to let their cash just sit on the sidelines. Of course, these investors may also have a passion for art or cars beyond the monetary value that these items may have. But it's safe to say that many of them do see luxury products not only as a thing of pleasure, but as an alternative asset class to bonds and stocks. One major difference with alternative asset classes, though, is that they tend to be more difficult to assess. There are fewer buyers, there are fewer sellers for these items, so it's difficult to get a handle on their risk and their price. The problem today for some of these investors is that this risk is now at their door, and the value of their luxury properties appears to have stalled out and may be now in the process of actually deflating. The returns for these asset classes are starting to sag, and in many cases are actually tumbling. The venerable British real estate company Knight Frank tracks a luxury investment index, and in 2016, that index posted its weakest performance since 2009. I saw a quote from Andrew Shirley, the editor of the report, and he said, and I wrote it down here, that across most sectors of the luxury investment universe, buyers are becoming more cautious about paying too much for their acquisitions. Now, in fairness, it's not all bad news for luxury investments. Luxury company stocks are beating the average market returns, and there are still occasional stories of moonshot bids at art auctions. You know, I recently saw an example of a Basquiat painting that just sold for $110 million at auction. But by and large, the trend is in a downward direction. Now, one asset class that is getting punished especially badly right now is high-end real estate. We're talking about luxury condos and mansions and extravagant city apartments. There's an oversupply of luxury real estate inventory in cities like New York and Miami and other places across the country. Now, what defines the luxury and ultra-luxury price range varies in different locations, but the story is largely the same. The speculative buyers and foreign investors who have been responsible for much of the demand in luxury property have largely disappeared, and one of the reasons for their disappearance has been the recent strength of the dollar, which has made U.S. property far more expensive for Brazilians and Chinese and other foreigners. And they've responded by retreating from this sector of the market. So the bottom line is that luxury real estate markets around the country now appear to be correcting, and that's usually defined as a 10% decline. So it remains to be seen how much further prices will have to fall to bring those buyers back. Some realtors specializing in luxury property in Miami are even saying that the market is worse than the crash of 2007. That's a pretty dramatic statement. Not only that, but there are many who believe that things will have to get worse before they actually get better. Miami is suffering from a glut of luxury condos and building is ongoing, and there are some estimates that it currently has enough inventory to last for the next 6 to 8 years. You know, that's a huge amount of inventory. One of the greatest risks in building these large products is the disconnect between current demand, which at the time they start building could be high, and then the time it takes to finally complete a project. What may look like a good bet today can sour quickly if demand dries up due to a recession or just plain old overbuilding. And we see this cycle over and over again. Now, demand doesn't even have to fall off a cliff, and this is important. Considering the amount of money borrowed needed to get these projects off the ground and then finally completed, even a slight softening can bring things to a crashing halt. Now, I'm not saying that's where we are today, but developers are getting desperate and are now offering huge incentives to brokers to move these properties, raising their commissions and the like. Realtors are advising clients to cut their asking prices dramatically if they want to sell in the next 2 years. Otherwise, they should expect to hang on to their property a lot longer. In New York City, the pain was being felt most severely in homes listed for over $20 million. According to broker Darren Sukenik, this is a direct quote, "Nobody is drinking the Kool-Aid anymore. When it was go-go times and people were just throwing money around, people bought into that dream." Of course, the people buying into that dream had very large stacks of money sitting around that they could play with by speculating on extremely expensive real estate. A Russian oligarch lost hundreds of millions of dollars on art investments in the past few years. But does that actually make a dent in the art market? And even if it did, who would be hurt other than other big-time art collectors? So you may ask, why do I care? What effect does any of this activity in luxury markets have outside these rarefied circles of the super rich? It's hard to see a direct effect on the middle class. There is a paradox, however, that in as much as luxury real estate's decline, instead of spreading a contagion to lower prices to the non-luxury spectrum, it's actually causing an increase in the prices of properties directly below luxury class. And the reason for that is these would-be luxury buyers are now seeking greater value at lower prices, increasing the demand for sub-luxury properties. With all this activity, whether it's luxury or sub-luxury, there are jobs at stake as well. These include profits and losses for luxury goods makers and a myriad of other businesses directly or indirectly tied to the real estate market, and there are many. On a positive side of things, if you happen to win the lottery or inherit a boatload of money in the next few years, you may be able to pick up a high-rise condo in South Beach, a vintage Ferrari, or a Picasso painting for a steal in the next couple of years. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I spend a lot of time reading, and in that process, I continually discover new thinkers and writers who enhance my knowledge and make me a better person and investor. I think I just found one of those individuals, and fortunately, because of the show, I often get to get them to join me, and so I can talk to them in more depth. Michael Batnick is Director of Research at Ritholtz Wealth Management. He's a member of their investment committee and heads up the company's internal research efforts, and I've asked him to the show to talk about a wonderful new essay he just wrote called 10 Things Investors Can Learn from the Horse Track. Hey, Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Good to be here.
So needless to say, that title, 10 Things Investors Can Learn from the Horse Track, caught my attention because I have discussed numerous times on this show the parallels between investing and poker playing, but I never thought about it in terms of other forms of gambling. I guess before we begin, let's get this straight. I'm sure you think investing has risks, but would you put investing in the category of gambling?
It certainly can be if you're not careful. I would say that traditionally, the way that investment is thought of is not gambling. Ostensibly, somebody's doing some sort of analysis, whether that's a deep dive on a company that they're investing in or something as simple as an asset allocation plan, and hopefully they understand the risks and the rewards and do not gamble by jumping in and out or trying to time the market or picking stocks and then abandoning them a week later and those sort of things.
Yeah, I wanted to make that separation clear because I know people who've been unsuccessful investing on their own often say, well, you know, it's just a big lottery. It's just a big casino, I should say. And I often say, no, it's not really when you understand how this stuff works. But if you treat it like a casino, it can become a casino. Okay, so let's get to it. So here's number one of these 10 things. I don't know if we'll get to all of them. Analysis is only half the battle. Investors don't pay enough attention to execution. And so we're talking about horses now. And remember, I think in a lot of these cases, you said we can just substitute the word stock for horses. So it's about handicapping properly. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the direct quote was, if you handicap well and bet poorly, you failed. And that couldn't be, the parallels are obvious. I mean, you could do fantastic analysis, find a stock that's selling for 9 that you think is worth 20, but that, you know, and it could eventually get to 20, but that doesn't mean that you'll be there when it does. Mm-hmm. So execution is really underrated and probably not enough attention is paid to it, especially when you see things like backtests. So I would say that the gap between what would have worked in the past and actually implementing it is probably much bigger than it looks.
Well, you say it's as useless as crushing your tee shots and three putting every green. right? So you can do all this wonderful analysis, but I guess, you know, you can pay too much for a company, even though it could be the greatest company you've ever seen. Or, like you said, it could take too long to achieve the goals that you sought and you would bail, you could bail earlier. Is that what you're talking about?
There are countless ways of not doing it right. And you just hit on a few of them. But yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
So fundamentals are how fast a horse runs, and the expectation are basically the odds. So discuss where odds come in. Now, I know, you know, with horse racing, if you've ever been to the track, you know, you can see what the odds are. But discuss that in terms of investing in companies.
Yeah, so that was from Michael Mabison, who actually put me onto this article. I think I found this in one of his brilliant pieces, The Success Equation. The direct quote was, horses that everyone perceives as having a 70% chance of winning pay substantially less than $4 because the odds are determined by the amount of money actually bet on each horse. And this goes right to the matter that people just pay too much attention to the company that they like or the product that they like and way too little attention to value. So they don't think in terms of probability or in terms of what's potentially priced in. And of course, it's very difficult to know, but they pay too much attention, again, to the story and not enough attention to actually what's going on beneath the surface.
You quote Charlie Munger, who's, you know, Warren Buffett's partner, and he says, we look for a horse with a 1 in 2 chance of winning, or let's say a 50% chance of winning, but that pays you 3 to 1. I think that kind of encapsulates it, doesn't it? The fact that...
Yeah, I can't put it any better than Charlie Munger did. As a matter of fact, Warren Buffett, when he was a kid, sold a newsletter at the track called Stable Boy Selection. So they both think very similarly in terms of horse betting. And when Buffett's father took the family to Washington, when he became part of Congress, one of the first things that Buffett asked him to do was to go to the Library of Congress and ask for every book on horse handicapping.
Uh-huh.
So he learned a lot of lessons early on,
yeah,
and the similarities between betting on horses and finding, you know, the best odds. And maybe this horse will win, but everybody thinks this horse is going to win. And therefore, yeah, the risk reward is not favorable on this horse you know, has a 10% chance of winning, but is being paid out like it has a 3% chance of winning. That's where you want to focus.
Well, I mean, you know, it's fun to say that, you know, when you're talking about horses at the track, but actually kind of figuring out that probability, I think it's a little more difficult, or at least it's another set of challenges when you're talking about a particular stock to buy. You know, years ago, Peter Lynch, who is famous for writing One Up on Wall Street and these great books written for public consumption, he was also a very successful head of Fidelity Magellan Funds years ago. You know, he would basically say, if you walk into a store and you see something that you really like, and you find out the company that makes it, they're a public company, you just go ahead and buy it. But anyway, how do you kind of figure out this probability aspect of it with stocks that you were talking about, figuring out the odds in horse track?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that a lot of people toss around the term or the phrase, something is priced in, mm-hmm, way too frequently without really, maybe not necessarily understanding what it means, but how do you handicap what's priced into the market,
yeah,
or what's priced into a company? I don't know the answer to that. It's extremely difficult. You know, measuring investors' expectations is a pretty difficult thing to do.
Yeah. Well, you also say or write that investors pay too much attention to glamour and too little attention to value. So even a horse with a very high likelihood of winning can be a very good or a very bad bet because it all depends on the odds once again. And I often, and I'm going to restate this, it's important. You can have the most perfect company, the greatest level of earnings growth, foreseeable into the future as best you can, and you can pay too much and you can lose an awful lot of money. So again, it's paying too. And also the market gets very much caught up in glamour, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely, because everybody looks at Amazon or Microsoft or whatever the company may be in the rearview mirror, and they don't think about how insanely difficult it was to obtain those gigantic returns. And the price of gigantic returns are gigantic drawdowns. So it's extremely difficult to get, and no company wants to be a value stock, right? That is the market saying, I'm sorry,
yeah,
your business stinks, or yeah, your fundamentals or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, it just perpetuates. So it's the exact opposite thing with glamour, is that people think that this is going to continue indefinitely. And of course there are exceptions, but by and large, growth stocks there's an overgeneralization, but growth stocks underperform value stocks because, and I'm using the phrase that I just said was used way too often, but because a lot of the future growth is already priced in. So markets do a pretty good job of discounting what's going to happen. And is Uber going to grow 30% a year for the next 10 years or whatever the expectations are? Maybe not.
Well, I think Apple is a great example of that. I mean, Apple was the quintessential glamour stock a few years ago.
Yep.
Books were being written, movies were being made, and the stock was just going up and up and up. But a lot of that growth had already happened. But now, because everybody can relate to a story like Apple, where you can see the iPhone and the iPad, it became very popular and it became very, very expensive relative to that. Now, today, the company is going through the typical iterations of a normal company cycle. Hot product becomes stale. They look for new ways to improve the product. And I don't think Apple, people working at Apple got stupid all of a sudden. It's just going to take time for them to figure out their new direction. And now I think Apple's a value stock. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I would agree. It's certainly making the transition to value.
Yeah.
It's been a while since it made a new high. And this is sort of shocking. I think that for the last 4 years, or just about that, it has not beaten the S&P 500.
Yeah.
And that's what Howard Marks refers to a lot as first level thinking. And that's what people get caught up in. What the average investor thinks is, what a great company. I want to buy Apple. And of course, they only come to the realization after, you know, several thousand percent increase. But then second level thinking says, well, yeah, it is a good company, but everybody knows that. And perhaps it's not as great as everybody thinks. So maybe it's a sell or an avoid.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's one, and this will be the last one we'll really only get to talk about. But there's always a temptation to abandon your strategy when it's out of favor. So let me read to you from your writing here. If you begin espousing this approach, you're sure to suffer abuse from your fellow horse players when one of them asks you who you like in a race and you say, well, I think number four is a bigger price than he should be. The likely response is, so what? Who do you like? Your cronies are apt to tell you that you should always be betting on horses, not on prices. And after an inevitable stretch of watching some of theirs win, you'll begin to doubt yourself. That's a big part of investing, isn't it?
Yeah, and just to be clear, of course, that's Stephen Crist who wrote that. I was just pulling from him. If I had written that, I would be much more famous than the recognition.
Well, maybe
I have,
you're on your way to being famous.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. Every single stock and strategy and theme and asset class goes through periods of underperformance. I guess staying on the horse and the Buffett Munger thought.
Yeah.
Buffett obviously got killed in the late 90s, and Barron's famously wrote on the cover, "What's Wrong, Warren?" Mm-hmm. And over a one-year period, Berkshire underperformed the NASDAQ by 140% at the worst, and over a three-year period, they underperformed by 230%. So everybody knows that value investing works and that Buffett is really smart, but even he had to go through a period of scorn and mocking and contempt and all those sort of things. And that's just the way the markets work. Whatever you're doing, whatever stock you're buying or strategy you're employing, particularly on the value side, it's going to be painful at times. Yeah. And that is the price for higher returns.
Very good. My guest is Michael Batnick, Director of Research at Ritholtz Wealth Management. He's also a member of the investment committee, heads up the company's internal research efforts. Michael, we're going to have you back on for other articles that you've penned. And I thank you for spending your time with us today.
Pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, PomeranZ.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, PomeranZ.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. The song you just heard was written and composed by my next guest. He is a multi-platinum award-winning songwriter and recording artist. His projects have earned him 22 platinum and 18 gold albums, selling over 40 million records worldwide. He's collaborated with many artists like Missy Elliott, the late great Freddie Mercury, Barry Manilow, Kenny Rogers, Bette Midler, and even the Muppets have sang his tunes. His work has been on soundtracks like Big, featuring Tom Hanks, and most recently HBO's hit show, The Leftovers. So now that you know that I'm not just talking to anyone, I'd like to officially welcome David Pomerantz to the show. Yes, David
Hello.
Pomerantz. Fun fact, David is actually my cousin, and I've invited him to share with us some of his experiences and give us some behind-the-scenes look at today's music business. If you have an aspiring star in the family or just plain curious, you'll want to listen closely. Dave, hey, welcome to the show.
Hey, Stephen. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you,
but
too.
Stephen, yeah. We're cousins, but you never call.
I write, though. I do write.
Yes, you do. It's lovely to speak to you, my friend.
So you've been in the music business for a couple of years. I remember your first album in the 70s and love that album so much. You're a great songwriter.
Thank you.
But the business has changed a little bit since those years. Tell us about the evolution of the music business.
Well, it's been interesting, and I think anyone you talk to will have a different bunch of things to say. But my experience is that, well, of course, when I started in the 70s, you had hard records. There are actual record stores, and you could buy them in stores. And the royalty system was very, very clear, is that every record, the songwriter got paid X pennies, and the recording on the singer got paid, blah, blah, blah. So if an album sold for $15, you knew, depending on how many songs on an album that each of those people got royalties for, how much you would make. And it was very simple. And there are entities that collect royalties for artists and for songwriters. The ones that collect for songwriters are called publishers, which is a very interesting story. Anyway, but the bottom line is it was a very simple system. And then came along, cue the Jaws theme.
Yeah.
Came along the digital revolution.
Yes.
And the demise of record stores. Nobody needed to buy those hard vinyl things.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, fewer and fewer people needed to buy CDs. And now there are downloads and things, something called streaming and things. But mm-hmm. the bottom line is that the content, it's almost like the credit card phenomenon with money. You know, there's no more money. It's hard to find cash.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
everything right. is, you know, you go on an airline and they say, oh, sorry, we don't take cash. Mm-hmm. For your sandwich, only credit card. So it's a little like that. It's a credit system, and it doesn't necessarily include any hard material, CD, record. So that has been the most major change. So it's an accounting operation, really, and it's how many venues, how many places can you put your record or your song? iTunes is one place. It's like a little online store,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah.
But there are many others that exist. And so the trick is to find the different, I guess they're called platforms, on which you could put your song or recording. And it's like an old time store.
Well, do the pennies still come in like the old CDs you mentioned? You're still getting pennies from every play?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. They are smaller.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot about this, by the way. And there are those who are much more experienced in it, but things like Rhapsody and Spotify and yeah. places like that.
Pandora.
They will play your song, but they seem to license bushels of songs or baskets of songs
yeah.
from publishers.
Yeah.
And then they pay percentages mm-hmm. of whatever they pay for the whole mm-hmm. to each songwriter and singer. And it's a smaller sum.
Actually, a thought that I hadn't thought about for so many years just popped into my mind when you're talking about royalty checks and the like. There was a time years and years ago when I was a professional musician and I was writing guitar books for Columbia Publication.
Mm-hmm.
And you were recording, I think, for Columbia because one day I saw a royalty check. I got your royalty check instead of my check for writing guitar books. And your check was much bigger. I just want to let you know.
Wow.
It's like, you know, I was going to change my name, but yeah, so that was kind of interesting.
Yes.
Little side. So, you know, I actually have my own singer-songwriter in the family. My daughter is traveling and writing and publishing and the like. And it's always this question about how is she going to make money in this brave new world when actually everybody has access to putting up something on YouTube. Everybody can be a musician, can be a star in their own right now. How does a true talent actually break through?
Well, it's a fascinating question. First of all, I do want to say that you're a great guitar player.
Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, he's still playing the guitar. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe a time for another show. We'll discuss that.
Okay.
It's an interesting time. I'll say one thing that it's an interesting context to put it all in. Back in the 1920s and 30s, the performer was king. You got Al Jolson and Fanny Bryce, and then later on, you know, others that were the...
Yeah.
They were the point, you know, is the point.
Frank
you go
Sinatra,
see them in concert.
The draw, yeah.
Sinatra,
yeah.
Judy Garland.
Right.
And the records that they made were it's almost souvenirs for their concerts or their appearances.
Mm.
So would you go to the store to get them? But it was thought of as something you buy to remember the great concert you saw.
I see.
With the great appearance.
Okay.
And then the Beatles came along and that whole era came along where it flipped and the recording started to make so much money that artists started to tour or do concert to support the sales of the album.
I remember that.
Right. That's what we grew up with, and which is a complete flip of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So the album was king, and the concert supported and promoted the album, which you buy, and everyone made a lot of money. And now it's flipping back.
Mm.
And so the way for a writer or a performer to make money, whether they're brand new or old school, you know, been around, is to tour and to do concerts. And in fact, the record companies have gotten into the concert promotion business because they know that they're not selling like they used to.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're getting a percentage of the artist's tours.
You know, before you go on, it brought another idea to my mind, and that is when artists would tour to promote a new album, you'd go to the concert and you'd hear this new music and you didn't really go to the concert to hear the new music.
Right.
It's kind of frustrating, right? So, you know, a smart artist would put the old music and the new music in, but a lot of times they didn't do that. And that was kind of a disappointing experience, but continue on.
Right. Well, to hear something, I don't want to hear that new song. I want to hear the one I know.
That's
right.
Right. Exactly.
Right. But to answer your question, I think any artist now, it behooves any artist to show up somewhere and sell your merchandise. You bring along your albums to the concert. And if you when you see the big guys, you know, and you see Bon Jovi is touring, their merchandise income is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happening right on site, you know. And if they sign the CD, oh my gosh, it's so much more.
Yeah.
I'm very successful with my records in places like the Philippines. And when I go to the Philippines, I play in huge arenas and do these meet and greets and signings for hours afterwards and can charge more. I don't charge to harm anybody, but I charge more because I'm there and I'm signing it and they appreciate it and like that. So there are ways for an artist to make money that's not the standard way of going to the record store.
Yeah. So you guys got to work a lot harder now. I mean, you're traveling all over the world right now.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. I do. I do.
As a matter of fact, you're traveling to Boca Raton in a couple of weeks. You'll be at the Boca Black Box Center for the Arts. How did I do? Did I work that in? Kind of
very, very good.
Thank you.
It's not as far as the Philippines. And
it's
I'm
not
very pleased about that.
it's July 22nd at 8 p.m. It's up close and personal with David Pomerantz.
Yeah.
So, David,
yeah.
Who have you basically worked with? What artists? I know I mentioned a few at the beginning of the segment, but I know you had some big hits with Barry Manilow. Just take us through some of that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I wrote number one hits for Manilow, Trying to Get the Feeling Again, and one called The Old Songs. Trying to Get the Feeling I wrote on my own. The Old Songs I wrote with a guy called Buddy Kay, who wrote a lot of wonderful hit songs. And I've written for, my goodness, Cliff Richard, who's a big kind of UK icon. And then The Muppets and Freddie Mercury and John Denver, and even recently Missy Elliott, who sampled one of my recordings
Yeah, let me ask you about that. So when someone samples something from your recording, you get paid for that?
Oh, yes.
Okay, cool.
Very well.
All right.
Very well. If it's licensed properly through a proper publisher,
yeah,
and they want to use a piece of a guy's recording over which to write, some people don't know what they do. They write a new song.
Yeah.
They take like a little section of something and they loop it or repeat it through the song.
Yeah.
And then write a new song on top of it. The person who wrote or produced that little recording that they use does get money and gets a percentage of the songwriting income.
Well, you must love that, right? Because now you've got bits and pieces here.
What's not to like?
That's right. Exactly. You get a check. What was the Sammy Kahn said? You know that story about Sammy Kahn when they asked him what comes first, the music or the words? What does he say?
Oh,
yeah.
He says the phone call.
The phone call and then the check. And
a phone call, I get an assignment.
Yeah.
So anyway, the night of the 23rd of July at the Boca Black Box, I'll be doing a lot of the songs that people know me for.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be doing a couple of new ones. Not too many, sorry. You don't have to worry about it.
Okay.
No, but anyway, but it'll be really lovely. You know, I sang the theme to Perfect Strangers back in the 90s, you know, standing tall on the wings of my dream, that thing. I'll be doing that and kind of a potpourri of all the things I've been involved with. I've written shows for Broadway.
Right.
Kathy Lee Gifford and I had a show on Broadway in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And I had things on the West End of London, etc. So it's going to be a musical kind of a grouping of many things that I've done. I'll be doing my selections for my little Tramp show, which is about Charlie Chaplin.
Right.
And I do that as a one-man show, etc. Anyway, it's going to be a very warm, it's called Up Close and Personal.
It's a Saturday night. I think you said July 23rd, but I think you meant the 22nd, right?
Did I? Oh, goodness.
That's okay.
I certainly did.
I caught you. It's the Boca Black Box Center for the Arts in Boca Raton, of course, July 22nd at 8 p.m. Up Close and Personal with David Pomerantz. Dave.
That's right.
Thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Oh, you're...
I'm going to call you more.
You're my man.
Take care.
So you are so welcome. Thank you, sweetie. Bye-bye. Take care, all.
To find out more about David and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Hey, we're going to take this out listening to the Muppets singing the beautiful song that David wrote, It's in Every One of Us.
It's in every one of us to be wise. Find your heart, open up both your eyes. We can all know everything without ever knowing why. It's in every one of us, I am I.
It's in every one of us, I am I.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You're welcome. Let's talk about millennials today. It looks like they may be making a comeback here, especially considering that the percentage of homeowners have been declining in the U.S. for the last number of years. That's starting to change.
Well, yeah, what we're looking at right now, home ownership is about 64%. It was 70% before this great recession.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's these millennials that need to be able to, you know, start purchasing up houses. Households formed double the rate of renters' households in the first quarter 2017. So that's the first indication. We're seeing more household formations versus renter house formations.
Okay, so I'm not really sure what that means, but as the millennials grow older, they form a family.
Well, yeah, they move into a rental or they move into a house. So
and
for the first quarter, the amount of households that purchased were greater than the rents.
Okay. Well, that's a good sign, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is a lot of discussion all the time of whether it's better to rent or to own. And I think you can go either way, but there are some long-term aspects to ownership. Tell us about those.
Well, there sure are. You've got long-term wealth. Owning a home is one of the best ways to build long-term wealth. You know, the longer you own the home, in theory, it builds equity. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, freedom. Homeowners are free to renovate and decorate and do whatever they want to their house. And then finally, a family investment. You know, for many, homeownership is a lifestyle choice, a place to, you know, where they want to raise a family, build memories, be part of a larger community. So those are the three main reasons.
Well, this is not a definitive statistic. It is interesting to note that homeowners' net worth is set anywhere from 31 to 46 times that of a renter.
Right.
I don't think it necessarily means that owning a home makes you wealthier, though I think that would be a pretty big part of it.
No, it's a forced savings account.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
You know, and from what I see in my business, I'll have people come down from up north, and really all the money that they have is their Social Security mm-hmm. and the money that they got from selling their homes that they lived in for 55 years.
Exactly. I totally agree. Also, you know, we deal with a lot of people, and as they age, we find that if they're running low on money, there's always their home as the final equity. Most of those homes are paid off. And in numerous cases, I can tell you that that has taken people to the end of their days.
Right. And now they have reverse mortgages. Mm-hmm. And that's not for everyone, not to promote.
Yeah, we're not promoting anything here. Sure. But I mean, it is an option. It's kind of a last option. Now, more homeowners have regained their equity since the crash as well. Tell us about that.
You're looking at about 9 million U.S. borrowers have regained their equity since the height of the mortgage crisis mm-hmm. back in 2011. This is according to CoreLogic, based on the first quarter equity report. So, you know, that's all real positive. And then also, you think back, how many people were underwater?
Yeah.
And now you've got all these people that are now above water. They're building equity in their houses. They can actually see it. Right now, the average homeowner has gained about $13,000 in equity between the first quarter 2016 and the first quarter 2017. So that's substantial if you're looking at the average homeowner gain.
Yeah, and also at all during that same time, they've been paying down their mortgage to, you know, greater or lesser degrees, but still they're building equity that way as well. So this is all good for the economy, and it's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. There's a double whammy in the positive sense to this, because this means that, you know, the mortgage risks of default decline when we have this buildup of equity.
I know. So what are some of the areas in the country that had the most positive equity, and what are some of the worst areas?
Sure. Texas, they had the highest positive equity at 98%, followed by Utah at 98% as well, and then Washington, Hawaii, and then Colorado.
Okay. West.
All west. Go west, my friend. And then Nevada had the highest percentage of homes with negative equity.
Interesting.
Has something to do with gambling, I'm sure. And then here comes Florida.
Why is Florida always in the top?
I know, we're always on a list. Good or bad, we're on a list.
Really?
But this is Florida and a negative equity at 11.1%.
Which just means that the percentage of homes with negative equity is 11%. So 1 out of 10 homes in Florida are still underwater.
Right. And keep in mind that this number was a lot worse. So this is actually, you can look at it, this is a positive thing that we have.
Right, right. It's getting better.
This amount of negative mm-hmm. equity. Illinois is at 10%. New Jersey's 10%. Connecticut's about 10%. These are the top five states.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in sunny Boca Raton, Florida. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, .com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. It is said that someone turning age 65 today has almost a 70% chance of needing some type of long-term care service. That service includes support in their remaining years. So why isn't anyone talking about it? Well, I'm going to talk about it today. And to help me go behind the curtain, I've asked Howard Schwartz. Howard is co-founder with his wife, Mindy, of Schwartz Family Home Care, a licensed nurse registry. And Howard has been working in the home care industry for 25 years, and he's witnessed enormous change. And we're going to go behind the scenes to discover what we can expect if our own need for long-term care arises. Hey, Howard, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Steve.
So you work in this home care industry. You do this every day. Tell me typically what your day comprises. What kind of people do you see? What kind of services would I expect?
Well, in terms of the patients, the clients, and the families, we mostly speak to them by phone. So throughout the day, we're fielding calls from clients and their loved ones. Many times they're out of town, trying to decide how best to get care for their parents. And sometimes that's home care. Sometimes they're considering facility care, but usually home care is primary. Usually people want to stay home.
So something has happened in their life where they realize there's a need. At what point would I probably realize that myself or a loved one needed this type of care? What would I be looking for?
When you see them starting to fail a bit, they're not getting up maybe, they're not going out, they've become more introverted than they normally would be. And that's the slow, steady progression.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's acute, a fall. They're in the hospital. Sometimes, being in South Florida, a child comes to visit and they're horrified that there's no air conditioning on, the place is not clean. So those kind of things get things started.
Yeah, so you can tell when there's a line that's crossed between what normal living conditions and habits of a person throughout their lifetime, something has changed. That usually spurs some kind of call or decision.
Yes. And unfortunately, it's not always clear. Sometimes the client, the patient, doesn't see the need.
Yeah.
And sometimes it takes a child or a relative to identify it, because they're in the situation, they'll typically say, I don't need any help.
That was the question I was going to ask you next is, you know, in some cases, the individual doesn't really believe they need the help. They don't want somebody in their home. They don't want to go to another place. How do you deal with issues like that?
Well, there's numerous ways to deal with it. Some people just try to convince the loved one that they need it. A popular technique is to tell the parent, it's not for them, it's for me, the kid. I don't feel good about you being alone. Sometimes the tough love technique works, by telling them, if you don't get care, you're going to go to a nursing home.
Oh, I see.
You have to have care. You can't be home alone.
Well, you mentioned nursing home. Typically, there are a number of choices. Nursing home, you just mentioned, is one of them. We all know about, you know, going to a nursing home. What are some of the other choices that people have these days?
There are independent living facilities where people have a small apartment and they provide meals and activities. There's assisted living where people get limited care with ADLs, which is help with bathing and dressing. And typically it could be from 1 to 4 hours a day in those kind of institutional facilities.
It's like enhanced independent living, I guess, or more specific services for those who are past a certain point. But a nursing home is completely different, right?
Right. That is usually the last step. To go into a nursing home is where most people want to avoid.
Yeah.
But that's where people need lots of care. And actually, the truth, sometimes people wind up there because they don't have money.
Oh.
Because Medicaid will pay for a nursing home. It won't pay for the independent living, won't pay for the assisted living, so it won't pay for the home care. So some people wind up there, unfortunately, by default because of the financial. But most people start off with home care. That's usually the first step.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that question about home care. I would imagine that most people want to stay in their home. I think the term is age in place. It's where they're used to living. It's theirs. You know, they're comfortable there. Is that an option that is increasing in popularity, or where does that fit within the other three options you just mentioned?
Most people want to be home, and some people want to be home even if it's not the best place for the situation, because they're friends, they're comfortable, especially as people age and they become cognitively impaired. They're very comfortable in their home. Once you take them out of their home, a lot of times they fail. They start to decline.
Yeah.
Even when the kids have the best intentions, moving them in with them, they become totally out of sorts. I had this with my own mother-in-law. When she had dementia, we brought it to our house. She couldn't handle it. Mm-hmm. She did fine in her place in Delray Beach. Out of her house, couldn't deal with it.
A nursing home would have been even worse.
Right. Yeah. Would have much worse.
Yeah. Wow. So what does it actually take to get adequate care in your home? Because that's a whole new set of needs that have to be filled, and you don't have a necessarily professional staff there or an institution taking care of you. So how do you set something like that up?
First, you have to identify what the client needs. People call us and they say, my mom needs help. Well, that's a broad spectrum. Mm-hmm. So we ask questions. Are they bathing themselves? Are they dressing themselves? Are they active? Because our goal is to match the right caregiver to that client need. So step one would be try to get an idea about what the person needs. Do they like to go out? Are they socially active? And then express that to the provider of care.
But that person that comes in may need some nursing skills or other kinds of skills. So what are the levels available in home?
The most basic level is typically people that would need help. We call them activities of daily living, or ADLs. Mm-hmm. And those are bathing, dressing, feeding, toileting, and transferring. Transferring is helping someone from bed to chair, sitting to standing. Those are the basic activities of daily living, and those would be provided by a certified nursing assistant or a home health aide in Florida. And they're trained to help with those items. Secondarily, they can help with shopping, cooking, they do light housekeeping, driving, things like that. But the five core items are typically what starts the ball rolling to get some care.
I'm speaking with Howard Schwartz. He is the co-founder and president with his wife, Mindy, of Schwartz Family Home Care. And today we're really trying to find out what goes on behind the curtain. You know, we can Google this all we want, and there's no lack of information and articles written, but I found something missing when I was researching this, and that was this idea of what is it like to be doing this every day, and what is the real human experience behind this type of event in a person's life. So that's why I've asked you here today. Let's discuss payment. Where's payment come from for nursing home care or for in-home care? What are the ways that this can be paid for?
Okay. There's several payers. The first is Medicare. Medicare pays for very little in the home. A lot of people think it will cover a lot, but it's skilled, intermittent care, and they have to meet the guidelines for that. So typically, someone will come in and do a visit. A nurse will come in a half hour, three times a week. They might get some therapy. But what most people need in the home is an aide. And that's where Medicare is lacking. So that's the other part of the care. Medicaid in Florida pays for very little in the home. In some states, it does pay more for home care. But in Florida, it's pretty much pays for the nursing home.
I read that there's an institutional bias with regards to this, that Medicaid would rather pay a facility than pay for in-home care, which in a sense limits the playing field or the choices a lot of these people, especially if they want to stay in their home. And I think to some degree, staying in your home might be less expensive than being in a nursing home.
Yes, it is. And it's unfortunate. And people do not want to go to a nursing home. And yet that's the place the government will pay for it. Mm-hmm. It's reverse in terms of what people want.
So Medicare, you mentioned Medicaid. I guess money also comes out of the individual's pocket, of course, to pay for this. That would be kind of obvious. What about insurance companies? Now, I'm sure most of my listeners have heard of long-term care. This has been insurance that's been around for a while. You pay a certain premium every year, depending upon your health and your age, and it's supposed to pay these kinds of expenses later in life. What's the current state of play or the state of insurance companies and long-term care?
Okay, long-term care is a dynamic industry. It does pay for home care if you qualify, and typically you have to need at least two of those activities of daily living.
Mm-hmm.
But the industry is in flux. Recently, there's been a lot of consolidation, big rate increases by the carriers, and they're getting tighter on claims because all of them say they're losing money. The other part is a recent development. One of the big insurance companies named Genworth was recently sold to China.
Mm-hmm.
So people are concerned.
To the country of China or to a company in China?
It's China, ocean. Well, in China, sometimes the country is
the, right,
yeah. Right. It is a big insurance company in China,
okay.
But somehow they're related to the premier of China.
Okay.
Recently, Penn Treaty, which has been an insurance company that's been around a while, went bankrupt.
Mm.
So there's been a lot of turmoil. But there is a state guarantee fund that will pay the claims.
Right.
It limits the policy. For example, we had a client that had a lifetime benefit with Penn Treaty.
Yeah.
When it goes into the state guarantee fund in Florida, it's limited to $300,000.
I remember many years ago, there was an insurance company that sold annuities and that they went out of business. And so the state plan came to bear and they've immediately lowered the guaranteed rate on the annuity. And it's the same thing because they don't have to honor the whole contract. They just have to kind of honor the basics of the contract.
Right.
Yeah.
And it become confusing because each state guarantee association gets involved depending where they bought the policy, depending where they're getting the care.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a very frustrating situation.
Are you seeing a lot of payment for services with these policies now? Is that declining? Is it becoming less and less? Or has it stayed stable? Is it increasing?
It's a big part of our business, people that have long-term insurance. So I'd say it's been fairly stable.
Okay.
There's still a lot of old policies on the market.
Yeah.
They haven't been here for a while. They only paid for home care. Those are the ones that seem to have been sold, the policies, and now there's a lot of turmoil. For example, when you call to figure out benefits, you're getting someone offshore.
Mm-hmm.
The company's been sold two or three times, so they don't even know what the benefit is.
Yeah, that's not a great thing. So let's talk about need. Typically, if a person needs long-term care, on average, how long do they need that care? How many years or so would I expect to use it?
It's a big variation. I mean, we have people on claim for a month, and we have one client 13 years.
Okay.
So in average, I would say 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
Women tend to be able to keep the care longer because they live longer.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say that would be a general average. But there's something else, Steve, it's a little interesting. People who have the lifetime benefits, they tend to live longer and keep care longer. We always laugh about it. The people that have a short benefit, it's one of those
they're
things.
Doing everybody a favor.
Right.
Because they want to leave some money behind or something like that.
And also, they don't sell the lifetime benefits anymore. I failed to tell you that before.
Yeah.
That was something that used to be sold, but as part of the industry, they stopped selling it.
Well, now they now have these hybrid policies. So you may have a life insurance policy or an annuity that can convert early if needed, right?
Right. And I have not had claims with those new policies because regarding the home care, we see things later. So I'm not sure how those policies will perform because we haven't actually got involved in them.
Interesting. So if you're listening to this and you're being offered a hybrid policy, at least the gentleman I'm talking with today hasn't really seen them perform yet. So just, I guess, do everything with the kind of a wary eye. Let's talk about costs. So typically, if I go to a nursing home, what can I expect to pay?
Nursing homes, annually, run about $78,000 a year. Mm-hmm. It varies state. Mm-hmm. But again, most people don't pay it. Most people, even if it's short term, they usually go on Medicaid.
Okay. All right. So the government's paying for that.
Yes.
Okay. What about in-home care? What's the cost per hour and I guess an average number of hours? I mean, there's a lot of variables here, right. But just in general, what are those costs?
Down in South Florida, it can be from $14 an hour through $20 an hour,
okay.
Depending on where you are and how many hours you get. But a typical starting point would be part-time help, let's say 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. That's how a lot of people start.
So are we talking about $180 a day?
Right.
Kind of thing. So figure $150 to $200 a day when you're doing your math.
Right.
Something like that, right?
Right.
Well, you know, Howard, we are out of time. I know it goes fast, but I want to reintroduce you here. My guest is Howard Schwartz, co-founder and president of Schwartz Family Home Care. And what is your website address?
www.schwartzfamilyhomecare.com.
Thank you, Howard.
Good to be here.
To find out more about Howard and long-term care, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. This week on the On the Money Minute, should you set up a charitable trust? Hi, Steve Pomerantz here with today's On the Money Minute. Setting up a charitable trust provides a double benefit. First, you get the prestige and satisfaction of seeing the money that you've worked so hard for go to a good cause, like a charity. Second, you get to remove certain assets from your overall taxable estate. You know, there are thousands of these charitable trusts being established every month. Some of them are surprisingly small. Others are quite large. Probably the largest charitable trust ever to be established is the one that Bill Gates set up. And you'll recall that later, Warren Buffett joined in to help, which today has a joint asset value running into the tens of billions. You don't have to have a billion to set one up, remember. In some forms, trusts can be established with just a few thousand dollars. To hear more on the Money Minutes, plus Steve's weekly radio show, go to stevepomerantz.com. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.